Tampa Bay campus, together with my colleague, Brendan Berry, from the same campus. And this is the Constitution Today. I have to say this first, our little disclaimer, that the opinions that Brendan and I set forth today are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of Thomas M. Cooley Law School, nor in its administration, nor the faculty at large. Good morning, Brendan. How are you today?
Good. Good morning, Jeff. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. It's been a eventful weekend. We'll talk later about this subject, but it was interesting that I got a, I'm kind of housebound right now because I got a call yesterday from a friend of ours who we were together with about a week and a half ago for a birthday to tell me that her husband has tested positive for COVID, even though he had been vaccinated. But the problem was that he is in autoimmune problems, as well as taking steroids for the surgery he had, and so he had no antibodies. So I'm housebound until later this morning after we finish, when I head over to Walgreens to have my quick test done. And so I've been kind of locked up. These are like the old days. I'm locked up in my apartment.
Mm-hmm.
Not what I had in mind for today. So be that as it may,
yep.
It's another hot, muggy, oppressive Tampa weekday. And so for those of you who are up north who think it's really awful that it's raining, I'll take it. Anytime you want to send it over here. We get a lot of rain here anyway, but after it stops raining, it's even muggier than it was before. So
yeah.
So what's
yeah.
going on with you today, Brendan? Anything new?
Not much. I feel bad for you. I mean, I feel bad for your friend who's tested positive. You wonder whether he didn't catch it from somebody who refused to get vaccinated. As long as there's a large population of people who, for mostly political reasons, decide they're just simply not going to get vaccinated, that just points up that we're all vulnerable. And so, at any rate, I'm vaccinated, and I can still leave my house because nobody's called me to tell me that they have COVID. So
yeah. Lucky you.
Yeah, lucky me.
So hopefully today I'll be set loose today, but we'll find out. I had to cancel a number of appointments. So, I mean, I don't think you want me in your barbershop today, and I don't think you want me at your physical therapy place today. And they all went, yeah, you're right. Call us when
right.
you get a negative test. So I said, okay, I'll call you back.
Right.
And I desperately tried to get one yesterday, but they were booked up. And that's surprising. In one way it's not surprising. In one way it is. It's surprising because supposedly, at least according to the governor of the state of Florida, we're doing just fine. No big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, cases are going up and people are getting worried about the Delta variant. And so they're getting things done. And here's which leads me into how we do a segment every week. Each of us gets to pontificate, if you want to call it that, or at least comment on what they really think about a subject matter that has struck them over the past week. And my subject is not a new one, but there are new things happening. And the bottom line is I'm going to talk about Marjorie Taylor Greene. I'm going to talk about Lauren Boebert. I am going to talk about some of their other cohorts who, for one reason or another, find it necessary to either announce that they are Nazis or play that they are Nazis, to be pretend Nazis to get votes from the real Nazis. Mm-hmm. And anybody, and when I say Nazi, I don't mean you're Adolf Hitler. But that's pretty much how we identify the Nazi Party. But the Nazi Party in and of itself was a xenophobic, racist organization who believed in the superiority of the Aryan race, or in other words, white people. And over several months, Representative Green has flirted with comments or been direct with comments equating actions by the so-called left or the Biden administration as being somehow equated to the actions of the Nazi Party during the 30s in Germany. Excuse me, I apologize. We refer to them as far right-wing people, but they are and believe in all the same things that the Nazi Party believed in. They are anti-Semitic. They are xenophobic. They are, and I have said this before, frightened as many Germans were, over the loss of their national identity. And in this country, the loss of national identity applies to white people who are sensing that their grip on power in this country is coming to an end, and that they have to do things, and we'll talk about more of those things later today, to stem the tide of this loss of white privilege, as we refer to it. For whatever the reasons are, Ms. Green, just weeks, after having apologized for making anti-Semitic remarks and improper references to the Holocaust, announced one morning that she would have a major announcement and a major press conference later that day, and then took a 15-minute trip to the Holocaust Memorial and the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., which is a five-story building, and with each rung of stairs that you walk up, you see more and more devastatingly graphic symbols and examples of what the Holocaust was really about. It does, and I will tell you, having been there and having to have to stop at one point after three of those flights because my 13-year-old son, who is as Jewish as I am, couldn't take anymore. He couldn't handle it. And yet for some reason or another, this white privileged, not neo-Nazi, goes to a Holocaust memorial, and she's done in 15 minutes. 15 minutes, and goes back and has a press conference announcing how that she's so sorry and that these references that she makes to the Holocaust are just so improper and that she now understands that we shouldn't be doing this and she shouldn't do this anymore, decides to make a reference to the brown shirts, so that you understand in a little history lesson, the brown shirts eventually became a group as large as 2 million members who wore just that old uniforms. Initially, they were just old uniforms that were bought at a surplus store. Eventually, many millions more were made. These were thugs. They were criminals, and their job was to ride around in trucks or in large groups of people and harass and intimidate the public, to harass and punish for no other reason than they were Jewish, German citizens. That was their job. Eventually, they became so powerful that the army told Hitler, we will not support you as long as Ernst Röhm and his brown shirts existed. And so Hitler created what was known as the Night of the Long Knives and executed Ernst Röhm, a known homosexual, by the way, and many of his leaders, and 2,000 of their followers who led the brown shirts, in a claim that they were going to overthrow the Nazi regime. That's how dangerous they were. Even Hitler was afraid of them. And he had the Gestapo. So she makes reference to the brown shirts in her claims that the program that the Biden administration wants to start by having people go door-to-door to offer, not mandate, but offer to people who have not been able to get vaccinated, vaccinations on the spot in their homes. And, of course, this immediately gets picked up as being an attempt to intimidate and force people to have vaccinations, which would be unconstitutional absent some edict by the executive branch that it's a national emergency of some sort, which it is, but that's beside the point. And claim, and her claim says that you can't force people to be a human experiment. Their whole big hitch here is that the FDA has not given final approval. It's only an emergency approval. Now, the fact that hundreds of thousands of lives have been saved, and the fact that nobody has died as a result of the vaccine itself, which only claims to be 90 to 95% viable to keep you from even getting sick against the main strain and 78% against you getting sick against the Delta variant, all of a sudden now it has now become a mandate and people are being intimidated. People are not being intimidated. They're going to areas where vaccination rates are low and offering the shot. You don't want it, you tell them to leave, they will. No one can mandate. No one's taking down names, or as Mo Brooks put it, taking down names and kicking ass. This whole idea that these are brown shirts is just a way of projecting your own political thought processes, Representative Taylor Green. These are your thought processes. You have learned from your Lord and Savior, Donald Trump, that all you have to do is accuse people of what you're doing first before they accuse you. And then you can use your whataboutism out of the problem that you're creating. But she's not alone in all of this. That's the whole point. She is not alone. She is joined by one of our other favorites, Lauren Boebert, the shame of the state of Colorado, whose most... And I don't mean to diminish the value of a cocktail waitress, but her main claim to fame is that she was a cocktail waitress carrying a gun on her side in a bar that is open carry, and she pursues herself in the context that she is a defender of the Second Amendment, and she speaks in terms of Nazism all the time. Here, she called the people going door-to-door, catch this, needle Nazis. Needle Nazis. Healthcare workers that are trying to help people are all of a sudden needle Nazis. And that the Biden administration's COVID-19 mitigation strategy and compared it to Nazism. Her attitude being, don't even offer it to them if my people in my district are smart enough that they know where to go to get it if they want it. Well, maybe they can't go and get it. Maybe. Did you ever consider that the peer pressure to not be inoculated is so great that they'd rather have it done in their home so they could continue to claim I haven't had the vaccine when they have? Maybe like you, Lauren Boebert. This continued continued attempts to paint not the term Nazi on people who aren't by the people who are is purposeful. And the truth of the matter is that Laura Ingraham, who really is a Nazi, and then one of the people that I really would stand in her face and call her what she is, said going door to door, this is creepy stuff. Someone comes up to your door outside wearing a mask, showing up at your house, claiming to work for the government, asking you personal medical questions. What could possibly go wrong there? They might actually get a shot. They might actually get a vaccination. Oh, my God, this is horrible. By the way, you've had one, haven't you, Laura? Tucker Carlson says the idea that you would force people. Nobody's forcing anyone. My attitude is you want to get sick and die, fine. Get sick and die. I don't wish it on you, but if that's what you want, go ahead. Y'all are hanging out with each other. The Delta variant's going to catch up with you. I don't wish death on anyone. But I have to admit, as Brendan and I talked this morning, maybe it takes a lot of you getting very sick, being put in a hospital, having to pay medical bills that you don't have insurance for because you don't like Obamacare, lose your job, lose your house, be on the street. Maybe it takes a large number of you to have that happen to you to learn you're not so smart. In fact, you're just as dumb as the day is long. Your idiocy is the major trait that you exhibit. To have Fox and Friends host Brian Kilmeade, who probably is a product of the public school system, say it's unbelievable how offensive this administration is in getting with a pandemic that is clearly on the run. Yeah, we have it on the run, and now you're turning around and saying, nanny, nanny, poo-poo, and it's catching up with you. I give credit to Brendan for saying, hey, it's okay. Let them get sick. Then they'll have immunity, and we'll get to herd immunity. It's just one of the ways we get there. We just let everybody get sick. Some of them die, but the ones that don't, okay, they're immune. Stop calling people Nazis when you're the Nazi. A perfect example of this is what happened at Katie Porter's California town hall this past weekend. What do brown shirts do? They disrupt. They intimidate. They fight. They bully. 300 people and a few who are detractors of Congresswoman Porter, who's from Orange County of all places, a Democrat from Orange County. You know, that's about as rare as a unicorn. And they decided to disrupt her meeting and start a fight. This is what the brown shirts did. They intimidated people who did not believe as they do. They couldn't talk because they were stupid, criminal people, but they knew how to punch people in the mouth. They knew how to fight people. This is a disintegration in our political system. This can't be tolerated. Stop projecting Nazism onto other people when you are the Nazis. And that's what I think.
Yeah. And what I think is closely related You mentioned Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham, and they are becoming, and in particular Tucker Carlson, who I think has actually a bigger audience, they are becoming serious threats to national security and to the health of this republic. It's hard to overstate how sinister, how cynical, how dangerous this has become. First of all, to your point, you're correct that we actually talk about this in constitutional law. There is, you know, federal courts recognize it's not something that's listed in the Constitution or mentioned in the Constitution, but the Constitution does protect a sphere of liberty. That's a pretty broad word, the word liberty, that courts call sort of a zone of privacy. There are a number of places in the Constitution where the Constitution suggests or explicitly references the existence of unenumerated constitutional rights that have to do with personal autonomy, control of one's mind, one's person, one's home. And under that umbrella, courts have recognized specifically a right to refuse unwanted medical treatment. So the only way the government can force somebody to undergo medical treatment would be if there is, as you said, Jeff, some kind of emergency. There would have to be what courts call a compelling interest, like saving a life, which very well may be in play here. And the method the government chooses to achieve that interest would have to be what courts call narrowly tailored, the best possible way, right? The least intrusive way possible. So although it would be possible under these circumstances, right, a deadly pandemic, and the only way to stop it would be to achieve herd immunity. And that does require, it requires either that you be vaccinated or that you have gotten the disease. That those are the two ways that you develop antibodies and that we reach herd immunity. So it could be that the government would be justified under these circumstances, and we'll see if some local governments start to do it, to mandate vaccinations. But that's not what's going to happen. It's not what is happening. And as you say, the Constitution does protect us from unwanted medical treatment. So it's a lie that the Biden administration is trying to force people to get vaccinated. And the irony, I don't know, you pile irony on top of irony. Tucker Carlson now is running around saying that this is one of the biggest scandals in American history, this effort to go door-to-door in communities where not enough people have been vaccinated and the Delta variant is going to start exploding, going into these areas and offering people where they live the vaccine. That, according to Tucker Carlson, is the biggest scandal, one of the biggest scandals in American history. You can only say that if you have no familiarity whatsoever with American history, let alone ancient history. How about recent American history? How about the scandal of an attempt to overthrow the United States Constitution on January 6th? Tucker Carlson doesn't think that was one of the biggest scandals in American history. No. It wasn't that. It was the effort by well-meaning health officials to get people vaccinated so that people won't die. Now, we talk a lot about the psychology that has led us to where we are, the authoritarian impulses that have led us to where we are, the cult-like behavior of what remains of the Republican Party, a once proud party, and I rarely have ever agreed with the policies propounded by the Republican Party, but at least we could recognize at one time that there was an intellectual center, that there was some kind of judicial philosophy associated with Republicans and conservatism, that there were national defense implications, right, of being a conservative and being a Republican, There was a time when all that was true. It is no longer true. All that is true now is a professed loyalty to Donald Trump and his family. Here's the thing. Being in a cult is very dangerous. And what we're seeing now is that we've gone beyond a cult of personality. When you've reached the point where people will expose themselves, their communities, their families, their parents, their grandparents, their children, when they will expose them and each other to a deadly virus, the possibility of hospitalization, the possibility of having to be hooked up to a ventilator, the possibility of dying by choking and dying by not being able to breathe. By the way, I had asthma growing up. I know what it's like to be gasping for air and not be able to breathe. It's horrifying. You'd be willing to do this because Tucker Carlson told you on behalf of Donald Trump that COVID is an overblown hoax and that the vaccine is some kind of a conspiracy. Then you have gone from a cult of personality to a death cult, and we have to call it what it is. That's what I really think.
It is one of those things that we have seen cults in the past come and go. The last one we saw was the Church of Scientology, and we hear little about them anymore. They're still there, and they still own most of downtown Clearwater, Florida. But they've never become a danger to national security. We don't like who they are. We don't like what they believe in. We don't like the huge mass quantity of wealth that they have obtained. But then again, so has the Catholic Church obtained a mass quantity of wealth beyond anyone's real imagination. But this is different. This is much different. It is a cult no different than that which followed Mao Zedong. It is no different than a cult that followed the Castro brothers and Che Guevara. It is a cult that a cult of personality that followed Adolf Hitler. It is a cult of personality of one person. One person who is as ignorant as they come. And yet in his ignorance, he has become the world's greatest carnival barker. He makes P.T. Barnum look like a child. And yet they continue to follow. He's like the Pied Piper leading the rats into the river. And somehow, rather than stand up to the bully, an entire political party admittedly a minority party, but still an entire political party has chosen to follow Pied Piper into the river. It just boggles the imagination that our people have become so histrionic, that the people of this country have become so ignorant of the past, so spoiled in a belief that everything will be okay. We'll just put one person in charge, but we'll always have our rights and our Constitution. That their belief in this, and the biggest disappointment are the seniors in this country who long for the 1950s. Get over it. Ozzie and Harriet are dead. Desi and Lucy are dead. You're not going to get that world back. And leave a country to your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren that you had. Don't straddle them with authoritarianism. It's awful. It's terrible. It's selfish. Maybe it's because when you get older, all you have are long-term memories. You don't have short-term memories. Okay. You know, it's like when your kids have beetle haircuts and you hated it. Sorry. They grew up. Boy, go on and on about that. Failure of our educational system and all that kind of stuff, but I won't.
Well, and
we should talk,
you know.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it also strikes me that, you know, there's been a trend for a long time. When you listen to people on the right talk about what their idea of tyranny, and it's interesting, you know, their idea of tyranny, what they'll call tyranny, what would be something like the Affordable Care Act, right?
Mm-hmm.
Remember death panels?
Yeah.
Right, death panels,
yeah.
You know? So the Affordable Care Act contained, when it was proposed, they had to take this provision out because of the death panel allegation, but it originally contained a provision that would require insurers to cover end-of-life counseling. That's it, right? That if you are terminally ill and you and your family want to have help in navigating through that and in getting your affairs in order,
right?
Arranging for palliative care, that's it. That insurance companies have to cover that. That was all the law said. Somehow, Republicans turned that into, quote-unquote, death panels. Tyranny. The government deciding who's going to live and who's going to die. So it's tyrannical for the government to try to get people care. That's tyranny, as far as they're concerned. And now this is tyranny, trying to get people vaccinated. Well, that's just tyrannical, okay? But what's not tyrannical to these folks? Passing laws that target transgender youth is not tyranny as far as they're concerned. Passing laws about who's allowed to marry whom is not tyrannical as far as they're concerned. Establishing theocracy in the United States, requiring everybody to adhere to one's own religious tenets. That's not tyrannical. Establishing a Trump family monarchy in the United States, which millions and millions of people would support. That's not tyrannical. The suggestion that we shoot protesters, right, these things that are coming out now about the things Donald Trump said while he was president, using the Department of Justice to target your enemies and protect your friends, allowing 600,000 Americans to die on your watch while you ignore the worst public health crisis of the last century. None of that's tyrannical. That's not tyranny. No, tyranny is trying to get insurance companies to pay for end-of-life care. Tyranny is trying to get people vaccinated, even in their own homes, if need be. The world is upside down. I have given up trying to understand where folks are coming from on these things. Everything is its own opposite in Trump world, right?
And it's like I said, like I said, it is projection.
Mm-hmm.
It is claiming that which is not tyranny as being tyranny, so that when you propose tyranny of your own, it's whataboutism.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a response to what they did. We're not being tyrannical. That has always been Donald's foray. That has absolutely been his playbook to throughout the entirety of his life. It's always somebody else's fault. He does nothing wrong. He does nothing wrong. He accepts responsibility for nothing. He accepts credit for things he did not do. Like Mitch McConnell going to Kentucky and claiming what a wonderful thing all this money that was passed by Congress is, and I have brought $6 billion back to the state of Kentucky. You didn't bring shit to Kentucky. You voted against it. You didn't want your people to have that money. Now you're telling them spend it wisely, like you tell your kid. You give them a $100 bill and tell them spend it wisely. Tyranny. Calling people tyrannical for trying to save people, to try to help people. That's tyranny. Why? Because they want to thin the herd. Not their herd. The other herd. It's a numbers game. It's point shaving. And it's whataboutism. Based upon your own wrongdoing. And that brings us to the other subject that deals with just that kind of tyranny. Brnovich versus Democratic National Committee. This is, to most of you, this is the Arizona Voting Act challenge. Not the new one, but the old one. It was brought by the DNC to get an injunction to stop enforcement of these changes, of certain changes. And kind of, it's basically the second notch or the second step in the total emasculation of the 1967 Voters' Rights Act. For those of you who are too young to remember, those of you who are too senile to remember, for those of you who are purposely ignorant, in 1967, this country passed a Voters' Rights Act that called for certain states to have to seek permission to change their voting rights and anything reflecting the operation of their voting, of their votes, to protect against things like poll taxes or unnecessary restrictions. In other words, everybody gets to vote. And those states, I think there were 11 of them, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, how Florida got out from under this, I have no idea. Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, Louisiana, Texas, Arkansas, all had to get permission to change things. And a couple of years ago, and maybe you can enlighten everybody, there was the first step in all of this written by Justice Roberts. Brendan?
Yep. And you're right. It's a two-step, right? And that was step one. So in a case called Shelby County, Justice Roberts wrote for the court. At issue there was what you just described, which was Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which required preclearance. And it's interesting. You know, we've actually mentioned a few times on this program certain parts of the Constitution that authorized Congress to enforce the equality principle, right? One person, one vote. Congress clearly has that authority. But the 14th Amendment, which has the Equal Protection Clause in it, which applies to voting, says Congress gets to enforce the Equal Protection Clause. The 15th Amendment, which bars racial discrimination in voting, also says Congress gets to enforce this provision. So there's no question Congress has the authority to do that, and that's what Congress did. It enacted the Voting Rights Act, which has a number of sections to it, and again, like we just talked about, it required states to get preclearance. Okay. Incidentally, the last time the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized, something like 96 or 97 out of the 100 senators voted for it, and that was just fairly recently. That wasn't like, you know, half a century ago.
And it should be noted that because it was 97-2 or 3, that had to include a number of the senators from the states which were under these restrictions.
Right, right, right. Almost all of them. So the court and the conservatives on the court who purport to be, you know, or to exercise what they call judicial restraint, right? We're not going to overturn the will of the people, right, as enacted, as represented through their elected representatives.
Scalia's favorite phrase.
Yes,
Scalia's favorite
right,
phrase.
I mean,
This court should not be overruling the will of the people as exhibited by the acts of their representatives in Congress. That's what he used to say.
Right. And he was usually said that in the context of defending laws that were anti-LGBTQ, right?
He also said that in terms of the Fifth Amendment, by the way, 18 U.S.C. 3501.
Right. So, yeah. So when he had his ideology in play, he was all for the people's representatives making law and the court restraining itself. And here we have a case where there is explicit constitutional authorization for Congress to do what it did. And here's what the court kind of sank its teeth into. In both the 14th and 15th Amendments, in the part of the amendment that says Congress is allowed to enforce this, it says through appropriate legislation. Right? Congress is allowed to enforce the Equal Protection Clause and the ban against racial discrimination in voting by enacting appropriate legislation. Roberts took that as an invitation to the court to decide what's appropriate. So it's not Congress's job anymore to decide what's appropriate in terms of protecting people's right to vote. Roberts said, we will simply substitute the court's idea of what's appropriate for Congress's idea of what's appropriate. It's up to us now. Even though the Constitution says it's up to Congress, it's up to us now to decide what's appropriate. And here's the kicker. He announces in the Shelby County case that although racism and racially discriminatory practices were at one time in this country a problem, times have changed. Okay, so says John Roberts. Times have changed, and we have healed as a country, and we don't have these impulses anymore to undertake these diabolical measures, right, to discriminate against people on the basis of race. And therefore, this ban, right, this requirement, this preclearance requirement, requiring states to go through this process when they want to change their voting laws, he says this is just too onerous and too much of a burden on state sovereignty in light of recent developments and the, I suppose he thought the amelioration of racial discrimination in the United States. So this would be news to many of us who don't reside in whatever ivory tower John Roberts occupied at the time, that in the United States we've solved the problem of racism. As Ruth Bader Ginsburg famously said in her dissent, this is like getting rid of the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you weren't getting wet. The reason why the franchise, access to the franchise, access to voting, was expanding, the reason why the problem wasn't ballooning out of control was that we had a mechanism in place to stop it from getting out of control, and that was Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. So that was step one. The court got rid of that. Do you want to talk about step two, or do you want to go?
Let's bring up the new one.
Yeah.
Many people believed that by making that statement and by rendering that opinion, that the court had basically unleashed, for lack of a better way to put it, the forces of evil.
Mm-hmm.
That they had opened the gates of hell and allowed anything that wanted to get out to get out, because there was no longer a basis for which the government could try to stop these things from occurring. But there was remaining one additional provision of the VRA, which was the essence of what was the case of involving the Arizona case. Arizona had offered two methods of voting. One was in-person voting at a precinct center either on election day or during an early vote period, or early voting where the voter would receive a ballot by mail, and either they mail that vote back or they deliver it to what's known as a designated drop-off location, which could be a polling place for early voting. Arizona also permitted each county to choose a voter center or a precinct-based system for in-person voting. Some counties are so small and so few voters that there was just one place to go to vote. But in places like Scottsdale and Phoenix and Tucson and Prescott and Flagstaff, those counties were so large and so populated that a single center did not do the job, so they established precincts, which most of us have to deal with, by the way. Okay? In counties that used a voter center system, registered voters could vote at a polling location, any polling location in the county. In counties using a precinct-based system, registered voters could only vote at the designated polling place in their precinct. It should be noted 90% of Arizona's population lives in counties using a precinct-based system. If a voter arrives at a polling place, for example, and he goes to vote, but he's not on the voter rolls for that precinct, the voter was still allowed, as we put, to cast what's known as a provisional ballot. Almost every state has provisional ballots, so that people can vote and then have it determined whether that vote was properly cast or not. And after Election Day, then all the voting officials would get together, and they're called canvassing boards for the most part, and they would get together and decide this is a good vote, this is a bad vote. If the officials determine that the voter voted out of precinct, what's known as oops, I'm in the wrong place, you know, out of precinct, OOP, oops, okay, that's what they call it, oops, the county discards the ballot in its entirety. If the oops voter properly voted otherwise, in most of the races on the ballot, the vote would be counted. For example, couldn't vote for a state legislator because you weren't in the district, but you sure could vote for the congressperson that you're supposed to have, and you can vote for president, you can vote for senator. And the DNC challenged the oops policy as violating Section 2 of the Voters' Rights Act because it actually affected Native Americans. You remember them, the people that were here first, or the Hispanics, meaning people who come from Mexico or other Spanish-speaking places who were actually here second, and African Americans. We're here by force. The Arizona law permitted early voting for over 25 years. 25 years. Allowing voters, you know, catch this. You could ask for vote by mail ballot for only a single election or asking for it in numerous elections as you go along, or you could say, I permanently want to vote by mail. Send me a ballot for every election. And many of those people were obviously minorities. And you could also use third parties to collect and drop off ballots. It's called ballot harvesting. It
right.
is, to me, something that I find personally offensive. That's how I lost my seat on the bench. It's a system that was created over 20 years ago in Florida where people would go around wearing T-shirts and say, get out the vote. And everybody would think they worked for the county. They didn't. They worked for candidates who hired this service who would get people, in particular in senior facilities, to ask for mail-in ballots so they could tell the people that were at the center that worked there, when the ballots come, put them off to the side, we'll come back and help them fill them out. And when people said, I want to vote for that guy, they'd say, no, you don't want to vote for him. You want to vote for this one. Or they would mark the ballots the way that they wanted them marked and then have the people sign them. You can't do that at the polling place, by the way. That's called electioneering. So I really don't have a lot of sympathy for people who are in favor of ballot harvesting. Florida got to the point where you could only collect 5 ballots. You as a person could only submit 5 ballots. But some of these people used to collect thousands of ballots and submit them. I was down 15,000 votes before the polls even opened. And I almost won anyway. So the DNC challenged this House bill that was passed by the Arizona legislature as violating Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and the 15th Amendment. For some reason or another in all of these discussions, and maybe you can explain this to me, Brendan, nobody ever talks about Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution of the United States. And why those who claim that the government doesn't have the power to regulate state elections are just wrong.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to hold your local election separately, that's fine, but when it comes to federal elections, Congress has all the power in the world to do that. They didn't need the 14th or 15th Amendments. They had it in the Constitution from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Time, place, and manner, if I'm not incorrect.
Right.
And I don't understand, okay? So initially, after a 10-day trial, a federal district judge in Arizona, what a surprise, held in favor of the state. Mr. Brnovich, by the way, is the attorney general, who claimed he had standing of the state of Arizona. A panel of judges on the Ninth Circuit, and boy, Arizona got lucky here. They drew the only conservatives that were on the entire court and got an opinion affirming the district court, which, of course, in a motion for an en banc rehearing by the Ninth Circuit, was destined to be reversed, and it was. And said that the district court had just clearly erred in what it had done. The court found that Arizona's out-of-precinct voting policy, early mail-in voting policy, and Arizona House Bill 2023 in its entirety, in its ballot collection law, did not violate Section 2 of the VRA. And was not enacted with a racially discriminatory purpose. The state never came up with a real reason why it did it. It never claimed election fraud. They've been doing it for 25 years. And Republicans have been winning and winning and winning. Now that Republicans had won, they saw that the shoe was on the other foot. Now all of a sudden this is a bad thing. And Sam Alito, who I believe is the leader of the conservative wing of the court, it's not Roberts. It's Alito, who is now what we would call the chair of the Curia, For those of you who are not Catholic, I'll explain what the Curia is. The Curia is, for all intents and purposes, the cabinet to the Pope. They are the administrative arm of the Church. And we had a Curia. That's how the five Catholics in the past who were on the court at the same time were referred to as the Curia. It was Alito, Scalia, let's see, who else? I'm trying to remember who some of the others were because now they're gone. Thomas and two others were referred to as the Curia. Alito is now the head of the Curia, made up of Roberts, Thomas, Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, Alito, and Coney Barrett. And he writes in a 6-3 decision that the Attorney General had standing to attack or to defend the state's law. And technically he did. And basically gutted, for all intents and purposes, first it reversed and said now, you must have strict scrutiny. It's not open to any other thing because it deals with discriminatory action. It has to be strict scrutiny, which is a high, very, very high standard to meet if you want to attack a law. And then goes on to basically gut and make the same kind of finding that there's nothing discriminatory about what the state was doing. It was a solution without a problem. The only problem was for Republicans, white Republicans, who were losing elections for the first time. Their demographics were changing. White fear, white privilege. And we must defend it at all costs, even if we have to find a law, constitutional, that is clearly unconstitutional. That's what they did. And what do we get in return for all of this? The state of Texas. Yay, for the eyes of Texas are upon you. But I don't think we're going to have time for this because we only got two more minutes.
Right. Well,
right,
I'll add this. Well, if he's not around, I'll add this. Okay. The act itself, the voting rights. So Alito rewrote the Voting Rights Act. The act itself, recognizing that racists, when they legislate to try to take away the right to vote, that they never admit what they're doing. Obviously, all such laws will look neutral on their face. So to get around that, Congress said, and any voting measure that has the effect of limiting the ability of racial minorities to vote, what we call disparate impact, right, that has that impact, regardless of the purpose, is unlawful under the Voting Rights Act, and you can challenge it under the Voting Rights Act. Alito wrote in an intent requirement that you have to show not just that there's a disparate impact, that the effect of the law is to burden the right to vote for racial minorities, but that was the motivating purpose. Then he goes further, having written a requirement into the law that the plaintiffs show some kind of intent, he goes on to dismiss the factual evidence in this case that there was intent. The Ninth Circuit noted the use of racially suggestive and offensive videos in the campaign to get these laws changed, a history in Arizona of trying to stop minorities from voting. For example, a guide that was written in Spanish, a voting guide written in Spanish that had the wrong date for the election when the English version of the same voting guide had the correct date. Gee, I wonder how that happened. Right. These constantly seeing this misbehavior, And the Ninth Circuit said there is plenty of factual evidence here to show purposeful discrimination, intent to discriminate. And what did Alito said? He said that's offensive. It's offensive to say that these legislators had some kind of racial motivation. So we're back to Roberts's point, right, where apparently the belief among these justices that there are no racist legislators left in the United States. Again, naivete, ignorance, or evil, one or all.
It's kind of amazing to look at it when you talk about the fact of writing things in. This is not the first time that this group or a group led by Alito and Thomas has done this. I can go back as far as United States versus Staples, where it was unlawful to possess a fully automatic weapon, just unlawful to possess it. There was no intent portion. It was a strict liability crime.
Mm-hmm.
The thought process being if you own a weapon, you should know what it does. And Mr. Staples had a fully automatic AR-15. And Thomas in Staples wrote in saying, well, if the Congress wants it to be a strict liability crime without any scienter or knowledge of any sort, they should write it into the law. Otherwise, we are going to imply a knowledge requirement. You have to know that the weapon is fully automatic. How do you prove someone knows that? Except for by circumstantial evidence, like you own it. Even though the defendant claims, I never fired the weapon. I just bought it. I never fired it. Yeah, that's right. You always buy a gun that you never fire, even in practice. And let Mr. Staples go because he was offended that strict liability would put him in prison. So we're going to imply knowledge, in other words, intent. This isn't the first time that Thomas and Alito have involved themselves in this. And yet they speak of, you know, understanding the will of the people's representatives in Congress. No, you do understand, and when you don't like it, you change it. Don't tell me that you're strict constructionalist. Don't tell me that you're textualist. You're not. You're more guilty of legislating than liberals ever were, because you're just overruling Congress. Not on constitutional grounds, but because you just don't like what they did. So it's not the first time they've done this, and it's not going to be the last time they're going to do this.
No, that's for sure.
Okay, because all these liberal laws have to be torn down. Ozzie and Harriet are going to rise from the dead. That they were the true messiahs that would lead us into a good life. The Cleavers will be the first family. That type of thought process. So since we have not been interrupted by Hezzy, why don't we go for a little bit longer, because we want to get to what the effect of what we just talked about has been, and we're
right.
Seeing it play out in Texas today.
Absolutely. Sure, of course.
What we are seeing, and here's what's happening there, for all of you who don't know. During the regular legislative session, Governor Abbott and the Republicans in the legislature, recognizing that Harris County, as far as they are concerned, is out of control, and that there is this huge influx of left-wing commies into the state of Texas, had decided that they had to pass a whole bunch of laws that would impede and restrict the ability of African Americans and other people of color from voting in a manner which they voted for several cycles now, for which the Attorney General of the State of Tech, not, I'm sorry, the Director of Elections, the Secretary of State for the State of Texas had said, hey, we had the most secure, perfectly run election we have ever had. And that election scared the ever-living hell out of Abbott, who's up for re-election in 2022 and wants to be president of the United States. And so he and that legislature bought into the big lie. And in the process of it, when they went to go vote on it, they needed, I think, a 60%. I think it's like 60% has to be present for a quorum.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democrats ran away. They just, you know, left. They went, bye, bye, okay, and shut the legislature down. So Abbott and his best friend Costello decided that they would hold a special session to bring back this, among other things, quote unquote, by the way, not dealing with the Texas grid issues,
mm-hmm.
okay, electrical grid issues. He said he was going to fix it. He hadn't done anything. He called a special session. And so they walked in, and a couple of the really the worst onerous provisions were withdrawn, but still a lot of bad stuff was in there. Democrats decided last night that just going home wasn't enough. They privately, and I say this now, without use of public money, despite what Governor Abbott and the head of the Texas legislature said, money that was contributed or money of their own that they spent to charter two airplanes to take all of the Democrats in the Texas legislature out of the state of Texas and to Washington, D.C.
That was brilliant.
This special session, what? I'm sorry, what are you saying?
It was brilliant.
It was brilliant. It was brilliant in the context that they are in Washington, D.C. for another purpose to boot. They may mm-hmm. be there for over 30 days. Why? Because the governor has said, if they return to the state of Texas, warrants will be issued for their arrest for God knows what criminal offense. They will be brought back to the legislature, and they will be handcuffed to their desks. That's what he's threatening. I want to stress a point here. Okay? I want to stress again. Number one, God knows what charges. And number two, no public money was spent. Absolutely none. And any legislator has the power to absent himself anytime he wants. Well, guess what? Abbott, in the first time they walked out, defunded the legislature. There is no money in the budget to run the legislature. There is no money for clerks. There is no money for administrative assistants. There is no money to pay legislators' salaries. There is no money. Therefore, the legislature can't meet because it can't pay the people that work there. Talk about shooting yourself in the foot with your open carry gun. And they went up, they're up in Washington right now. Now Abbott says, when this special session ends, I'm going to call another one. And I'll keep calling special sessions until the election in 2022. I want these laws. It should be, again, remember the governor vetoed all of the provisions in the budget to fund the legislature. And they're up there saying, they're accused of, for example, They flew across the country in cushy private planes. They leave undone issues that can help their districts and our state, the governor said. And so you have to ask, what is the problem that the bills are meant to resolve? Is this another example of a solution without a problem? And again, the answer has to be yes. They tried to shame them by saying they're immature. The bottom line is they did what they had to do to protect their districts and to protect their citizens. These people support what they're doing. What they're doing is they're hurting the white privilege thought process. The fear Texans have. Texas is, by the way, the first state that has a law that has been proposed in the legislature to secede from the Union and become a country again. Because most people don't know Texas was a country before it was a state, and it became a country after the Civil War, after the first insurrection. They were a country for 2 years until they came back into the Union. The Republic of Texas. Maybe that's why they keep their grid off of the main grid. I don't know. Okay. But without any question, okay, this is what we see. We have seen it in Florida. The aberrant behavior of Republicans in our state legislature because they so overwhelmingly, due to gerrymandering, control the legislature. There was, in my time many years ago, a move by the people south of Lake Okeechobee to secede from the state of Florida and establish the state of South Florida. Because of the gerrymandering that gave the state north of I-4 and along the I-4 corridor all the power to just do and run roughshod over Democrats. We've seen Georgia, North Carolina, all these states that used to be controlled by the VRA have now been unleashed. And it isn't a stretch to say the new Jim Crow has begun. Mm-hmm. As if the old Jim Crow was ever really gone. That's what the Roberts Court has unleashed. I'm going to call it the Alito Court. Has unleashed. And that presses me to one last point about the court. Justice Breyer, stop hiring new clerks and issue your resignation. Don't be Ruth Bader Ginsburg. As brilliant as she was selfish. And she's cost this country dearly. For all the good she did, it has all been undone. You were selfish, believing you were indispensable. Well, Justice Breyer, you're not indispensable. You cannot wait until the end of the next term. Stop hiring clerks. You're 83 years old. Nobody lives for friggin' ever. Ask Justice Scalia. Do you disagree, Brendan?
No, and I'll just add two more points very briefly. One is, it is extraordinary what the Democratic legislators from Texas are doing, And I hope that whatever spirit they have going inside them starts to rub off on Democrats in the United States Congress, particularly two of them, Manchin and Sinema, because the legislators from Texas are going to be lobbying members of the Congress to do something. The only way this is going to stop is if Congress does something. They have to pass voting rights legislation now. As you've mentioned, they clearly have the authority to do it. They have to do it. They have to change the filibuster if need be, get rid of it if need be, and pass voting rights legislation. So happy to see that the legislators in Texas understand this is existential, and we need to see that same attitude from leaders of the Democratic Party on the national level. The only other thing I'll mention is that the Department of Justice suit against Georgia, the Department of Justice has raised the Voting Rights Act, is suing under the Voting Rights Act, challenging Georgia's restrictive voting laws, the new laws that Georgia has passed. We know now from Alito's opinion in the Arizona case that case is going nowhere. Okay, the Department of Justice, Democrats in Congress, you cannot rely on the Department of Justice to win these cases in court, not with Alito and Roberts calling the shots. So those are the only two points I would make in closing. But I agree with you, Breyer needs to get off the court before the Senate changes hands. But who knows what could happen? But if the Senate changes hands in 2022, then we know that President Biden will get no appointments to the Supreme Court during his first term. McConnell has already promised that. So I agree with that.
Yeah, there is no sense of urgency. And there is the fight. I want to look at Kristen Sinema in the eye. Okay, I want to stoop down and I want to look her in the eye. Okay, and I want to say, what are you doing? Who are you playing to? You did not get elected by Republicans, by the Republican base. You are not going to get Republican base votes. And the Republicans that voted for you believed in what the Democrats were saying. You want to keep your seat? Play to the people who put you where you are. You're trying to walk a fine line that makes nobody happy. This is just dumb politics on your part. Arizona's demographics are changing, and you fit into that demographic. Stop trying to be something you're not. Satisfy the people who put you where you are. Mark Kelly, do the same. Stand up. If you lose your seat in 2022, then you lost your seat, but look at all the good you'll do in the 4 years that you're there, or the 2 years that you're there. By the way, where's your gun legislation, Mark? Gabby got you there. Now do something for her. And Manchin, I understand to a certain extent what you're going through, but the fact of the matter is you got 69% of the vote as a Democrat in a state that Trump won. So spare me the problem that you've got. If you tell the people of West Virginia this is important and this is why I'm doing it, they will believe you. And you're on the long side of 6 years, not the short side. I know you want to be governor of West Virginia again, but you know what? Think about what you're doing now, not what you want to do later. If you guys agree to either a carve out or a change in the filibuster, which I was against, and Brendan knows I was against it, 6 months ago, if you'd asked me, I would have told you I was against it. But if you believe in a carve out for constitutional issues and pass this Voters' Rights Act, you'll be preserving your own seat and the vote of the people in your own state. It's time. It's time to play the way Republicans play. They change the rules, and you want to live by the old rules. And I guarantee you, no matter what happens, Mitch McConnell will change the rules again to suit whatever he wants. So change them to get what you want, then change them back to the way that they were with a 60-vote threshold to change them again, and then McConnell can't change them if he wins in 2022, and you can make that change back during a lame duck session. Play dirty. It's time. You can't keep getting punched in the face and say, oh, please don't hit me anymore. Sometimes you got to punch a bully in the nose. It's time for McConnell to be punched in his chicken neck. You like that one, Brendan? You're laughing.
I tell you, that's probably the note to end on, right?
I would say so. I would say that's a good note, okay? By the, you know, what can I tell you? Every time I see Foghorn Leghorn, all I see is Mitch McConnell. I can't help it. I'm sorry. Okay. Okay. Hi. You know, they just sound the same. Every day, blah, 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 blah. So I just, you know, Okay. God. Okay, I can't help it. I had to take that shot at him. It's a deep one.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Yeah,
what the hell?
Why not?
Okay, Hezzy, that's all we got for today.
That's all?
That's it. Sorry about that. I have to go get my COVID test. I'm sorry.
Yeah, all right.
Okay?
All the best on that.
How are you feeling,
yeah.
Hezzy? You okay? Let's ask him on the air.
I'm feeling good. Yeah. So thank
okay.
goodness, and very exciting discussion today. I didn't expect you'd cover Texas, but you did a great job.
Thank you. Well, I'm
right.
glad. By the way, have you lost any more weight, Andy?
I'm holding on. I'm at 180
okay.
pounds.
That's terrific.
Which is
really
unbelievable. I don't think I was 180 pounds when I was 16.
I was born 180 pounds, so I, you know, I'm okay. Okay. All right. Well, for everybody
right.
who's listening, we'll give it back to Hezzy, but at this point, we're finished for today. Brendan, have a wonderful day, okay?
You as well. Bye-bye, Hezzy. Stay well.
Okay. The best to you
bye-bye,
all.
Bye-bye, Hezzy.
All the best.
Take
Thank
care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, how exciting. It doesn't get better than Brendan Beery and Jeffrey Swartz, both professors of Constitution and criminal law as well at WMU Cooley Law School at the Tampa, Florida campus. Very, very exciting. Okay, well, let's move on to the next segment and cover first a local issue. And let me see if I could find it here. This is a hesitorial or an editorial. It's about Yonkers politics. It's past and present. And this will lead up. This is the second edition. The first one was published last week. This is the second one. And the final one will be next week. So it's called Yonkers Politics, Past and Present, written by me. And it notes out from the very beginning that Yonkers politics preparing for Yonkers future by Hezzy Harris will unfurl on the 20th of July. And it begins by saying that Yonkers will be reading and commenting. So please share your thoughts and insights. Each is pertinent. Each is welcome. Be exact and thoughtful in your writing. And this discussion is about our past, our present, and our future, because we all matter, and this is, after all, where we live, work, and play. And this is called the Hesitorial on Yonkers Politics. There have been many catalysts that guided Yonkers to the present. The history of Yonkers' past, as in every society, has molded Yonkersites into the present willingly or reluctantly. and tracing the past seems to glaze over most people's eyes, not so much because there is no interest, but because it has not been respected with the reverence it deserves. Because this is not a history lesson, we engage in only looking at the past 75 years, only three generations. Governance in place after the victories of World War II was predominantly white, with a black minority. An infusion of people from war-torn Europe emigrated to the United States with a significant Polish, Russian, Italian, Jewish, South Americans, Caribbean, and Middle Easterners who came in droves. They struggled to feed themselves, their children. The houses of worship, no matter the denomination, kept communities together, assisting the integration, building a society that stressed education and thereby advancement. But just as strides of advancement were being made, the desegregation case would come to undermine Yonkers, literally sharing it shaking it to the core, so much so that to this day, Yonkers struggles to get beyond its past. The desegregation case became a catalyst that changed the body politics of Yonkers as the entrenched politicians struggled with the changing attitudes and demeanor of the residents of the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s became part of the exodus. Some of the original settlers remained, others struggled as a change in less expensive manufacturing facilities undermined the financial capacity of the city. Well, a struggle that has only of late become less onerous as development makes an ever greater impact on the financial health of the fourth largest city in New York State. Well, many departed Yonkers for one reason or another. COVID-19 and its mutating variants has been loss of life and has seen loss of life and caused much anguish as employment opportunities were diminished exponentially. A new exodus caused people to invest in the northern part of Westchester County and even counties further north. Now, the infusion of federal funding is likely to bring Yonkers toward greater prospects for its citizenry and future economic growth. A tapestry of plight, success, new challenges, a pandemic, and now traversing build anew once again. Now, sensibilities and circumstances have changed to one extent or another. They forecast a future to captivate the city of Yonkers. Killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota transformed people's recognition of a reality spoken in hushed tones until it could not continue any longer. Bias, bigotry, lack of opportunity, lack of a living wage, homelessness, among other ills, have again brought the haves and the have-not into a battle of dominance, and that battle has begun in earnest. It is a battle that will be won by future elections. Yonkers' most recent election proved some most important issues: integrity, respect, compassion, experience, and knowledge matter. Past and future voters matter. While diatribes and allegations have been strewn about in media and social media alike, the assertions espoused are too often found in the reality of hearsay and not often enough provable. They are instead a stop as aspersions to malign an adversary years after the fact. Is Yonkers no longer in fear of ascribing their name to an assertion, or are they only comfortable in stating what they state anonymously because they are still in fear of retribution and thereby they have no outlet to infuse their position with proof and validity? Such needs require a vibrant media unencumbered by ethical deficiencies and willing, with proof at hand, to fight for and on behalf of the people they inform. What happened 30 to 40 years ago has relevance, but only as a prelude to the continuing lies and deceits that continue at present. There is, however, one solution and only one. It takes education, engagement, honesty, and probable facts and provable facts, and works when every potential voter knows what has happened, why it matters, and learns that a solution exists. All the elements are simple and succinct. Politics has learned to learn the process very well. Perhaps the public is starting to get it too. Well, voters have been undermined in Yonkers for many years. Politics have maintained the most important element not readily recognized in Yonkers. The voters, particularly the ones employed either by the city of Yonkers in the office of government or the Yonkers Board of Education, have been subliminally undermining the election process by their numbers, eclipsing the general electorate who do not work for Yonkers City Hall or the Yonkers Board of Education. So let us review the numbers, because numbers don't lie. There are approximately 5,000 employees who either work for the city of Yonkers or the Yonkers Board of Education. Whether gay, straight, transgendered, or questioning, they are married or have a partner, spouse, or partner of a Yonkers Board of Education or City of Yonkers employee is in most circumstances going to cast their vote for their spouse, partner, friend, associate by voting for them through the only surrogate that represents those employees, and that person is the mayor of the City of Yonkers. Those 5,000 employees who have doubled have now doubled to 10,000 votes, total votes in support of that one employee. Now, because Yonkers is an older community of residents, easily counted to be 50 plus in age, whether straight or gay, whether having raised a brood of two or more children sexually in marriage or within the family structure by adoption, that child is certain to be a voting age and will cast their vote by the only surrogate that will maintain that employee, that is the mayor of Yonkers. We now have 5,000 employees who will vote for themselves and the mayor, 5,000 more who will vote for their partner by voting for the mayor, and an additional 5,000 more for the adult children of this employee by voting for the mayor. We have now learned that 5,000 employees can muster a total of 15,000 total votes And this dynamic has worked for every Yonkers mayor who has run for two terms. The outlier to date has been Yonkers Mayor Mike Spano, who asked the Yonkers City Council to permit him to run for a third term, as had been the case with New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg, who asked the New York City Council to extend the two-term time in office for a third four-year term. Mimicry is the kindest form of flattery, and Mayor Mike Spano beseeched the Yonkers City Council to do likewise. They did, despite the Yonkers City Charter only permitting a maximum of two four-year terms, not three four-year terms. Well, many people wanted Mayor Mike Spano to get a third four-year term, extolling his proficiency at the political helm. The group that believed it was necessary to continue with Mayor Mike Spano lost. Was unnecessary to continue with Mayor Mike Spano lost. Mayor Mike Spano won a third term handsomely. Now, only days after the primary election ballots have been decided and the general election pitting Democrats and Republicans against each other in some cases, while races that have been won in the primary election challenge face no challenger whatsoever. Well, the general election will be held 4 months from now, that is, in November 2021. Which begs the question, will Mayor Mike Spano seek a fourth term, four-year term in November of 2022? Well, that's the question. We'll find out eventually. Part three is entitled Yonkers Politics Preparing for Yonkers Future, again written by me, Hezzy Harris, and we'll unfurl on the 20th of July next week. And that needs still to be written. I'm going to move over to something else. I looked at this article in reading it to you, and I know for sure I reread it. There were quite a few spelling errors here, and I know that I fixed them all yesterday. Somehow when I ended the, or thought that I had updated, go before it was posted, it turns out it didn't take it. So those same issues are still here. I'll correct it after we end the show at 12 noon. So my apology if you've read it already. And so we'll see how that all goes. Now let's look at some other things. Bear with me a moment. One second. All right. Where is it here? Well, let's look what's going on in Afghanistan, which we discussed yesterday. Evidently, the Taliban are warning Turkey against extending its troop presence in Afghanistan amid the U.S. pullout. Well, the Taliban on Tuesday warned Turkey against extending its troop presence in Afghanistan when U.S.-led forces leave the country, insisting the decision was, quote, reprehensible, end quote. Continuing, the quote is, the decision is ill-advised, a violation of our sovereignty and territory, territorial integrity, and against our national interests, the group said in a statement, and days after Ankara, the capital, agreed with Washington to provide security for Kabul airport when foreign forces leave next month. We consider a stay of foreign forces in our homeland by any country under whatever pretext and occupation, the Taliban had said. As foreign forces wind up their withdrawal due to be completed by August 31st, the situation on the ground is changing rapidly. The insurgents have swept through much of northern Afghanistan in recent weeks, and the government now holds little more than a constellation of provincial capitals that must largely be reinforced and resupplied by them. On Tuesday, the head of a Taliban commission that oversees government forces who surrender to the insurgents urged the residents of cities to reach out to them. Now that the fighting from mountains and deserts has reached the doors of the cities, Mujahideen don't want fighting inside the city. Amir Khan Mutahi said in a message tweeted by a Taliban spokesperson, using another term for the group. It is better to use any possible channel to get in touch with our invitation and guidance commission, he said, adding that this would, quote, prevent their cities from getting damaged, end quote. The strategy is one well worn by the Taliban, particularly during their first rise to power in the 1990s, cutting off towns and distinct centers, district centers, and getting elders to negotiate a surrender. The top U.S. general in Afghanistan relinquished his command on Monday at a ceremony in the capital, the latest symbolic gesture bringing America's longest war nearer to an end. Well, the pace of the pullout and multiple offensives launched by the Taliban have raised fears that Afghanistan's security forces could be swiftly overwhelmed, particularly without vital U.S. air support. Around 650 American service members are expected to remain in Kabul, guarding Washington's sprawling diplomatic compound. The Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said on Friday it agreed with the United States on the, quote, scope, end quote, of how to secure Kabul airport. And peace talks between the insurgents and the government, supposedly taking place in Doha, have largely fizzled out, and the Taliban now appear set on a complete military victory. But claims by the hardline group to control 85% of the country are impossible to verify independently and strongly disputed by the government. Last week in Moscow, a visiting Taliban delegation said that the group now controls more than half of the country's near 400 districts a claim steadfastly rejected by security forces spokesperson Aimal Omar Shinwari. Still, the situation has alarmed foreign nations, and on Sunday, India became the latest country to evacuate some of its diplomats. On Monday, Russia announced it was relocating some diplomats to Uzbekistan, while China also evacuated 210 nationals from Afghanistan. Unbelievable. So we'll just see what's going to happen here, that's for sure. The French have been called on, the French have called on its citizens to leave Afghanistan amid security fears. And so we'll just have to see where all that ends. But it seems like this is leading up to an unbelievable massacre. So we'll eventually find out. This is very interesting. While here there is no such authoritarian directive, a mandatory vaccination of COVID-19 pass and access to PCR tests are the main points of Macron's recent address. So French President Emmanuel Macron gave a televised address on Monday night as the Delta variant of COVID-19 surges in the country. He announced further measures to slow the spread of the more infectious variant and outlined plans to make vaccination compulsory for health workers. French President Emmanuel Macron began his address by speaking about a surge in infections of the COVID-19 Delta variant in mainland France and its overseas territories and urged French citizens to get vaccinated. Quote, "If we do not act today, the number of cases will continue to increase," he said. Macron explained that the government was striving to achieve a 100% vaccination rate across the country. Vaccination will become mandatory for all health workers. Macron urged them to be inoculated by September 15th, after which they could face potential sanctions or fines. Vaccination is a, quote, matter of individual responsibility, but also a matter of our freedom, the president added. France's health minister, Olivier Véran, said that non-vaccinated health workers won't receive a salary, not be allowed to work after September 15th. Macron announced that a vaccination campaign for high school, secondary school, and primary school students will begin when school starts again in September. Among other measures, a curfew will be reinstated in the French territories of Martinique and Réunion Island. A PCR test will no longer be free of charge from the autumn unless they are obtained with a prescription. Macron said it is hoped that the measure will drive up vaccination rates by encouraging people to get the vaccine rather than just repeated COVID-19 tests. Well, this summer will be a summer of economic recovery, he stated, adding that the health passport or QR code or certificate proving that the holder has a negative COVID-19 test, is fully vaccinated, or recently recovered from COVID-19 will be required throughout different establishments in France from August, including bars, restaurants, cafes, and shopping centers. Soon after the president's address, France's online health portal, doctolib.fr, crashed because of too many people trying to book vaccination appointments. Well, France reported 1,260 new coronavirus cases on Monday, July 12th. The rate of vaccination has slowed in the country, and France has gone from an average of more than 400,000 injections a day at the end of May to about 165,000 injections per day currently. Around 40% of the population has received two doses of a COVID-19 vaccine, while 53.1% has received one dose. And while France and other European countries are tightening restrictions to curb a further rise in cases, the United Kingdom is pressing ahead with plans for Freedom Day on July 19, when most pandemic-related restrictions will be lifted. Unbelievable events, that is for sure. And we'll have to see where that all goes. One moment here as we move on to the other articles I'm looking for? This is interesting in what's happening in Ethiopia's Tigray region. The rebel forces in the Ethiopia's Tigray region have launched a new offensive. Well, Tigrayan forces have launched a new offensive in the conflict-torn northern region of Ethiopia 2 weeks after the federal government declared a unilateral ceasefire in the face of rebel advances. A spokesman for the Tigrayan forces advised that they had seized Alamata, the main town in southern Tigray, after launching the offensive on Monday. "We promise to liberate every square inch of Tigray," Getachew Reda said, adding that fighting was also taking place in western Tigray. Well, the claims could not be independently confirmed because communications were largely down in the area, while an Ethiopian military spokesman did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Well, the Tigray Defense Forces last month swept across large parts of Tigray and seized the regional capital, Mekele, after 8 months of brutal conflict with federal troops. Fighting marked by grisly massacres and widespread sexual violence has killed thousands of people, while the United Nations says that hundreds of thousands are on the brink of famine. Security forces and officials from the neighboring Amhara region had moved into both the southern and western areas of Tigray in November in support of the Ethiopian army after Tigrayan forces cleared out during the early phases of the war. Well, yesterday, meaning on Monday, we launched an offensive in the southern region of Raya and were able to absolutely rout Federal Defense Forces and Amhara Special Forces divisions, Geshu had said. "We have been able to secure most of southern Tigray, including Korem and Alamata, the main town in the area." Geshu said Tigrayan Defense Force fighters were still in hot pursuit of pro-government fighters, adding, "We don't want to give them a chance to regroup." The offensive was launched just 2 days after election results showed Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed had won a landslide in a June election that went ahead despite the Tigray conflict that has battered his global reputation. The Tigrayan Defense Force had described its seizure of Mekele and most of Tigray as a major victory and branded the government's unilateral ceasefire a, quote, joke, end quote. Rebel leaders later said they accepted the ceasefire in principle, but posed strict conditions, including the withdrawal from the region of Eritrean and Amhara forces. Abiy and other officials have countered that federal forces executed a strategic pullback to focus on other threats. Abiy, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019 for his efforts of rapprochement with neighboring Eritrea, sent the army into Tigray last November to oust the region's once dominant ruling party, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the PTLF. Abiy had accused them of orchestrating attacks on Ethiopian military bases in Tigray, an important economic and industrial region in the Horn of Africa nation. So that's what's happening there. And very, very compelling sort of stuff. Now, let's just see one other thing here. One second. All right, we're almost there. This is very interesting. On a watery stage, La Scala, the opera house, conquers a new public. And this is very, very interesting. Under the night sky, dancers leaped on the wooden stage, floating on an illuminated swimming pool, a fairy tale experience from Milan's La Scala as it seeks to reach a wider audience. The lights reflected in the turquoise water of the enormous net-covered pool of the Bagni Misteriosi, an iconic 1930s venue transformed into a theater. It's magical. It's the first time I've been to a performance by La Scala, said Federico Smaldino, a 47-year-old office worker watching the show on Monday night. A ballet fan, she has promised herself she will visit the theater itself soon. The program included contemporary pieces, including Sentieri by Philippe Katz or Movements to Stravinsky by Andras Lukács, as well as classics such as Swan Lake and Don Quixote, choreographed by the legendary Rudolf Nureyev. We wanted to present as many different pieces as possible to show the range of La Scala Ballet, ballet director Manuel Legris had said. It's a particular pleasure because here we are meeting a new public who do not necessarily have the chance to go to La Scala. Like the spectators, by the end of the performance, he had fallen under the spell of the baths. It's an era where you can dream, and it transports the dance into a truly fairy tale world, he said with a smile. The performance was one of a series of concerts staged by La Scala for free, ranging from jazz to Vivaldi and Donizetti, passing via Brahms, Bach, and Rachmaninoff. Retired Milan resident Rita Tonari, 67, was among the rapt audience and expressed her delight at the initiative. It gives people like me, who do not have a season ticket to La Scala, the chance to attend such a prestigious performance, she said. Moving sometimes fast, sometimes slowly, embracing fleetingly before separating Emanuela Montanari and Massimo Garon, performed a moving interpretation of Albakin by Simon Valastro to a poignant tune by Iceland's Olafur Anor. Then it was the turn of Swan Lake with a duo by Vittoria Valerio and Claudia Caviello, who seemed at times to be like feathers suspended above the waves. With the water around them, quote, you have to doubly be attentive on this slightly wobbly stage and take care not to slip, admitted Valerio, La Scala's soloist. She cherished the return of a live audience after a season marked by coronavirus closures. Spectators, quote, give us adrenaline, passion, and a desire to dance, she said. Coviello, her partner, said that such a performance provides a message of hope after the pandemic, which hit Italy hard and remains ever-present with most of its audience wearing face masks. Well, with three concerts, La Scala director Dominique Maia, who took over last year, wanted to recreate the spirit of the 1970s when one of his predecessors, Paolo Grassi, opened up the mythical stage to the wider public. Many people have never stepped through the door of a theater, but culture is for everyone, music is for everyone, he told, and rejecting the idea that it was reserved for an elite. Residents in buildings overlooking the baths were also given a free show on Monday night, watching out of windows, a performance that closed with a piece from Don Quixote that mixed classical dance and flamenco. And Grand Pas de Deux was performed to a frantic rhythm by the soloist and drew a thunderous applause. As if hypnotized, the spectators moved slowly to get out of their seats at the end, waiting in vain for more, before easing back into real life. Just a fascinating outcome, really truly amazing. So we'll see what goes on. Let's see, 1 second. All right. And this is really interesting as well. South Africa's ex-president Zuma has woken up in jail. Well, after days of drama and suspense before handing himself in, South Africa's Jacob Zuma began a 15-month sentence for contempt on Thursday after leaving his first night in jail. That's last week. Former prisoner of the apartheid regime had kept the country on tenterhooks by trying all legal avenues to evade jail, but Zuma became an inmate once again shortly after midnight. is the first time a former president has been jailed in post-apartheid South Africa. He handed himself in at a recently renovated jail in the small mining town of Estcourt in his KwaZulu-Natal home province. The sentence handed by to Zuma by the Constitutional Court last week for snubbing anti-graft investigators also set a benchmark for the continent in jailing a former head of state for refusing to respond to a corruption probe. Many South Africans hailed Zuma's incarceration as a watershed moment that would strengthen the rule of law in the country. Former corruption buster and ex-ombudsman bondswoman Thuli Madonsela hailed it as a glorious day in that it says that the rule of law prevails, end quote. If he had not gone to prison, it would have sent shockwaves to the system, she said, on a public television show last Thursday. The day before, police had warned they were prepared to arrest Zuma by a midnight deadline to enforce the ruling unless the top court instructed otherwise. But in the end, the former leader decided to comply. And just minutes before the deadline expired, his foundation tweeted that Zuma had decided to comply with the incarceration order and hand himself to a correctional facility. This is the second time Zuma, Democratic South Africa's former president, after Nelson Mandela and Thabo Mbeki, had been in prison. He spent 10 years in jail on the notorious Robben Island for his role in the armed struggle against the apartheid system. In a tweet, Zuma's daughter, Dudu Zuna Sambudya, said that her father had jokingly said on his way to prison that he hopes they still have the same overalls from Robben Island. Zuma had earlier in the week mounted a last-ditch legal defense and refused to turn himself in. On Wednesday, he then pleaded anew with the court for an 11th-hour reprieve, requesting that it suspend its arrest orders until all legal processes were finalized under the ruling. Police were given 3 days to arrest him if he failed to surrender. And Zuma's first application to have to hold his arrest was heard on Tuesday, but the judgment was reserved until Friday. And separately, he had pleaded with the Constitutional Court to reconsider and rescind its late order, and that challenge was heard the following Monday. Zuma, who's 79, was forced out of office in 2018, replaced by Cyril Ramaphosa after a nine-year tenure stained by corruption scandals and the taint of cronyism. Critics nicknamed him the Teflon president for his perceived ability to sidestep justice. But his fortunes changed on June 29, when the court issued a damning judgment against him for contempt. Zuma had refused to obey a court order to appear before a commission probing the siphoning off of state assets under his presidency. At the weekend, he defiantly declared he was preparing to go to prison, even though sending me to jail during the height of a pandemic at my age is the same as sentencing me to death, he said. So that's the story of what happened there. Won't be able to read the rest, but you get the gist of it all. So that's the story. We'll speak to you tomorrow. Tomorrow's Wednesday, and don't have enough time to look to see what we're going to be, what the schedule is like for tomorrow, but hopefully you'll join us then. All the best to you. Thank you so much for joining us today. Goodbye.